Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey and I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney, and my producers today are Anthony Dockrell and Michael Jones. This week on Fourth Estate, we're all about your right to know. On Monday, the country's papers in a coordinated campaign landed on breakfast tables around the nation with redacted text on the front page. It was a stark reminder that press freedom in Australia is under attack like never before. And today we're going to ask, has the Right to Know campaign moved the needle on this debate? And how does the news media get the public on side for this campaign? Also, the Walkley Award nominees have been announced, and there's a little bit more about that in a second, but the Walkley Award nominees have been announced, and they are the top gongs for excellence in journalism, and this year they include the Al Jazeera story, a scoop, called How to Sell a Massacre. In that story, you may recall, a journalist went undercover, not revealing his true identity, to expose some very disturbing links between the National Rifle Association in the United States and the One Nation's, Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. But in doing so, the journal broke the ethical rules that the MEAA and the Walkleys normally follow, that namely that a journalist must identify themselves as such. So the question really is, did the Walkley judges get this right? Making an exception to this piece of journalism, was it a question of the rules be damned? We're also going to explore several aspects of Indigenous representation in the news media. Firstly, how Indigenous voices are represented inside of newsrooms. And secondly, how Indigenous issues are reported. And, time permitting, we should touch on the big business story of the media week, the proposed purchase of regional TV channel Prime by Channel 7. Is this another blow for media diversity, or just a sign of the times when the only way to survive is to keep getting bigger and bigger? To discuss this and more, we are joined by two Walkley Award nominees, so no pressure and no conflict of interest here, and certainly no jinxing. So Michael Cosio is a Fourth Estate alumni and a journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. He's just been nominated alongside Jennifer Duke for their work on covering the firing of former ABC Managing Director Michelle Guthrie. Hello, Michael. Welcome.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Lorena.
And we are so blessed. Here we go. He's just scooped me. And we're so blessed to have the Indigenous editor of The Guardian, Lorena Allam, on the line from Alice Springs.
Hello, Michael. Hello, Peter.
And just in case you missed it, Lorena has also been nominated for the Walkley Awards this year for what is an amazing and excellent confronting and essential work called The Killing Time, A Massacre Map. Yeah, so best of luck both of you with that. We're not going to talk at length about the Walkleys because we'll talk about them when you've won one, okay?
Because that would be weird.
Yeah.
So
let's talk about press, the right to know. It's not often the media in this country speaks with one voice, but this week it did just that. Your Right to Know campaign aims to raise awareness, but also change the law and how journalism is conducted in this country. I mean, as we all know, so far this year, News Corp journalist Anika Smethurst on the ABC have been raided by federal police. In the move, many inside the media see as a clear warning to journalists and whistleblowers. And we've had, for instance, an example of the ABC chair, Ida Buttrose, among others, saying that those raids have already had a chilling effect on whistleblowers coming forward. And this is on top of a government that is now operating in what it seems to me, anyway, an ever more opaque, and secret fashion, stamping top secret on documents so that it makes them harder and harder to get under FOI. Michael, let's start with you. Are you kind of happy? Were you surprised by the campaign this Monday? And I guess what outcome are we hoping to see?
Well, I wasn't that surprised because I did know it was coming. And also, it's kind of been brewing for quite a few months now, certainly ever since those traumatic raids that you mentioned. So I think it's a good thing. You know, like any journalist, I'm, you know, constantly frustrated by attempts to contain and withhold information. You know, sometimes reporting on the Home Affairs Department and the immigration system, you're kind of constantly banging your head against a wall to try and get anything out of these people, often when it's just not even when it's kind of innocuous, it's not even, you know, Watergate or anything. It's just friend and colleague, well, not colleague, but my friend and fellow journalist, Paul Karp at The Guardian, was just this week trying to work out whether an invoice or a yearly statement included GST or not. And it's taken more than 24 hours just to get an answer on that basic question. So you encounter this sort of stuff all the time. And it's great that we are, pushing back against it in a very vocal and very forthright way.
I guess we're all on a bit of a unity ticket here, but Lorena, what do you think of Scott Morrison in Parliament this week trying to sit both sides of the fence? You know, he kind of said he was in favour of press freedom, but virtually in the same breath he said, oh, well, no one's above the law. So how does that sit? Was he trying to run both sides of the race here?
I don't know. Is it surprising when politicians try to have an each-way bet?
No, not at all.
I guess it's up, but I guess it's up to us to really question him about what that means. Whether we have access to politicians to properly ask them those questions is what I think is of concern to journalists, is the accountability that politicians have to the public via us seems to be shrinking. So it's people can ponder what he means until we have an opportunity to ask him properly. We can only speculate.
Well, of course, and there's a few other questions we'd like to ask him, like did he try and get Brian Houston to the White House? But he seems very good at managing the media. What's your take on the Morrison government in those terms, you know, in terms of not making themselves open to scrutiny?
I think if governments can avoid scrutiny, they do. So I'm up in the Northern Territory now and I'm a bit removed from federal politics this week. But what I can tell you about the Northern Territory government is they don't have a very robust FOI regime. They don't have disclosure logs for their departments, which is a common thing in the Commonwealth. You can go to a Commonwealth Department of Education and they will offer you a disclosure log of any and all FOI or Freedom of Information applications that have been made. The Territory doesn't do that, and it's very, very reluctant to provide that sort of information to journalists. It also doesn't have adequate whistleblower protection. There is no specific legislation up here to protect whistleblowers. So I think if governments of all types are able to avoid public scrutiny, that's often what they prefer to do.
And yet, at the same time, they say they're in favour of media, you know, media freedom. Michael, the New York Times has been cited a few times in this debate because there was a piece written by Damien Cave, the MIT person here, saying that, you know, Australia is the most secretive democracy in the world. Is that your take on it? I mean, that seems a massive claim to me, to be honest. But
well, yeah, I mean, I don't have the knowledge that would be required to make that assessment. And if Damien Cave does, then perhaps he does. I don't know.
Sure. We'll ask him about it.
I mean, look, I think we, you know, let's apply the same skepticism that we as journalists would apply to any other campaign that we would that we might encounter. I mean, you know, Morrison is kind of, you know, he's making a reasonable point that half the readers, I reckon, agree with, just judging by the feedback. A lot of people out there say, why do journalists think that they should be above the law? And actually, unless you are going to, as a journalist or as a media organization, make the claim that journalists should be completely exempt from all aspects of these laws, then, and you could make that claim if you wanted to, but unless you are going to say that, then you have to draw a line somewhere and you have to write a law that grants journalists particular rights, but not carte blanche.
But I don't think no one's arguing that the journalists are above the law, are they? I mean, this is a kind of classic red herring, isn't it? A political tactic to suggest
Well, I mean, we're certainly arguing that we shouldn't have the same laws.
Sure,
apply.
That we should be able to do our job.
Yes. Which is fair enough, I think.
But what we're saying is that the law does not offer the public adequate capacity to understand the decisions that are being made in their name.
Indeed.
So it's not about journalists being above the law. It's about journalists being able to operate within a reasonable law or series of laws. And that, I think, is what's at stake. We're not saying that we're above the law.
No,
and it's a classic political distraction tactic to even say that.
Yes, well, that's right. So, just on that point, you mentioned the public. I mean, one aspect of this, I mean, let's call a spade, is that journalists and politicians are both not particularly held in high esteem by the public. So, how are we going to get the you first, Lorraine, and then to you, Michael? How are we going to get the public on side in this debate?
I think appealing to their interests to say, well, we, and I think some of the sort of the advertising that come out this last week goes to this. So saying to them, we would not have an aged care royal commission were it not for the reporting of journalists who exposed the treatment of our elderly in nursing homes. We would not have an investigation into the atrocities at the Don Dale Youth Detention Centre if it hadn't been for the work of journalists. So if the public cares about the way its citizens are treated in this country, then it needs a robust media. It needs a healthy public broadcaster or broadcasters and a healthy media ecosystem. And part of that ecosystem is being able to operate under reasonable legislation. The Americans are quite astonished when you try and explain to them the restrictions of our defamation legislation. They have a very public system. I was talking to journalists in Norway who talk about Jealousy Day, which is an annual day in Norway where everybody's tax returns are made public.
Wow.
So and they see that as a fairly
name.
I love those Norwegians.
That's okay. That's how public they want to be about things.
Yeah.
So they just everybody's tax returns are made public in Norway.
Fair enough. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, well, I mean, we've got a long way to go then on that level. Michael, you spend quite a lot of time in Canberra. Do you think part of the problem here is that the political class and the journalism class are just too chummy, spend too much time together?
Oh, no, I don't think it's that. Look, I think, I'm not – you see this all the time, especially around the time of the Midwinter Ball when, people start – whinging about how, they're all just hanging out together and enjoying each other's company and they should be out there at the barricades, 24/7 seems to be the view of some.
Well, that's what the news cycle is.
I mean, I think that's rubbish. But, it's not chummy. I mean, any journo worth their salt would, kill for a story that brings down a minister or something. So it's not, I don't think it's a problem that, we're too close to the political class. But, I do think it is a problem for this campaign. And I think the campaign is pitched in exactly the right way. It's, it's about the stories. It's about the public's right to know. It's right there in the name. Mm-hmm. But I do not think you're ever going to get to the stage where people are marching down George Street for this.
In favour of journalism.
I just don't think it's going to. I mean, I'd love to be proven wrong, but I don't think that's going
to happen. I'm sure we'd all love to be proven wrong on that. Can we move on a little bit to the Walkleys, talking about journalism, and the Walkley Award nominations came out in this past week, and one of the nominations for, I think, Scoop of the Year was the Al Jazeera story, How to Sell a Massacre. So for those of you who may not know about this story, it involves an Al Jazeera reporter, Roger Mueller, working undercover and traveling with One Nation's James Ashby and Steve Dixon to America, where Al Jazeera filmed and participated in One Nation's attempts to gain money from the National Rifle Association, the NRA, and other gun rights lobbies. So there's a couple elements here to tease out, Lorena, that, there's no one's arguing about this. The reporter went undercover, broke the ethical guidelines. So was it justified? Was it the ends, were the means justifying the ends in this case?
I'm going to struggle answering that. So it wasn't the journal. It was Roger,
Roger Mueller.
The guy who went undercover.
Yeah.
Technically a journalist. He was a mate of the journalist. Maybe I'm splitting.
He was an associate of the investigations editor.
Yeah.
Right. Who chose him because he had his appearance and his demeanour gave, he seemed convincing in that sort of a role. So I watched the documentary. It was absolutely silly. And I do think in a way the things that it revealed were in the public interest. I'm not sure that I can comment on the ethics of it. I wasn't involved in making the editorial decisions around that program. But I have to say, as a viewer, it was absolutely compelling.
It was compelling, but just on that point, I mean, I guess the question really boils down to this. And as you say, we don't really know because we weren't on the team doing it, but was there any other way of getting that information and doing that story? I guess from the outside, it looks not.
Again, it's hard to say, but I doubt it. I think those sort of candid comments, you can't get them any other way. That's true. It's similar to footage that has been the police have used, I guess, to entrap people who are, the one that brings to mind is the cricket scandal in India, the bribery, match fixing scandals. But that was the kind of reporting that was made without the knowledge of another person. I think in the US it's quite legal in certain states to record a conversation, provided one side of the conversation knows it's being recorded.
Not the case here.
That's right.
Yeah. What do you think, Michael? About the ethical breach here.
I mean, I won't go as far as to say it's unethical, but I say that it definitely straddled the border.
Yes, pushes
of
against
ethics.
It. Yeah.
And I say that because, I mean, yeah, they did hire this guy who was a pet food business owner in Nowra or something, 5 minutes before he was doing this. So, he's not a lifelong
We shouldn't hold
journalist.
That against him.
No, but, he's someone who comes from outside the industry.
Yeah. Right.
Now he's operating under the direction of Peter Charlie, the investigations editor. So, you've got someone
with a long history.
Incredible at the helm.
Yep. Absolutely.
And, as a fellow journalist, I would trust his judgment.
Yep.
You also then have to face up to the fact that, they did kind of bring these people over here to the US, where they then, had meetings with the NRA. Now, the central allegation against them was that they went there to solicit donations from the NRA. Now, you talk to One Nation people about this. They're very unhappy with the way that was portrayed because they went over there to have meetings to learn, some stuff from the NRA, whatever it is you want to learn from them. And then, Mueller got them drunk and they started going on about it. It'd be nice if,
so there's an element of entrapment.
Yeah. I think you can certainly say that there seems to be some entrapment there. Now, are we going to spend all night crying over this? They're idiots. They got themselves into this situation. The footage kind of tells the story. But, on the other hand, this is something that, as I said, really straddles the border of what would be considered ethical in journalism.
Just to put you on the spot, are you going to be happy if it wins the Walkley?
Sure, I'd be happy for them. What's it up against? I don't know.
I don't have the full list in front of me. Lorena, were you happy if it wins the Walkley?
I can't answer that.
It'll be great because it'll be controversial.
Yeah,
that's what we want.
There'll be a good night in the Walkleys if that happens. Yeah, that's right.
James Ashby will hit the roof.
Well, James Ashby, maybe you'll get a Walkley. I mean, they gave one to Peter, what's her face? Credlin, tell me, just on this, just to finish on this, what about your own sort of ethics here? So would you, put on a wig and a pair of dark sunglasses, Lorena, to go undercover to get a yarn?
It would not be my only approach to a story, no. I would say no up front, but if it were part of a suite of other measures, as the politicians say, then I would think about it. But up front, no, absolutely not.
Okay. Interesting. Michael, wig, sunglasses?
Oh, yeah, I don't have a problem with camouflaging my identity because I think the general gist of it is if you're observing what's happening anyway, then that's fine. I mean, when you're creating situations for people, when you're engineering circumstances, that's entrapment, not playing dress-ups and secretly recording stuff. I think that's okay.
Yeah, because I guess the distinction here is, can you go undercover and kind of keep your hands clean? I mean, is it a smoking gun?
If you're bearing witness, that seems much more reasonable to me than if you're kind of engineering situations for people.
If you're getting people drunk and what have you.
Yeah. And if you're bringing them over to the US to kind of, make connections and all this sort of thing. I mean, he was the connection guy. He was the link. He purported to be this guy who was, in with the NRA. That's why One Nation believes it was a setup.
Yeah. Lorena, sorry.
You can't, I was going to say you can't publish I'll report anything that you have collected by means where you haven't declared who you are and who you work for. I would not. I would never do that.
Mm.
I wouldn't put on the wig and glasses,
right?
And without declaring to people what I intended to do and who I worked for.
Yeah, it's interesting. So because what's interesting about this is just a final point, I guess, is that it isn't covered by the ethics laws, the MEAA laws, or the Walkley's own guidelines. So does that mean then we need to change our ethics guidelines?
Very possibly. I mean, I agree. You should never misrepresent yourself as someone else. I mean, I'm happy to go and like sit at the back of a lecture theatre in a wig and, you know, kind of, you know, you know, that kind of undercover. But, you know, if you're actually going to tell people that you're someone that you're not, I think that definitely crosses the line.
Well, you can do that, but you can't republish it. You can't report it. That would be the line I'd draw.
So your line you're drawing, yes, okay, you could do that if that gave you information which you then, you know, declared in subsequent reporting kind of thing.
Yeah. Although if it was a pretty fabulous wig, I'd consider.
Yeah, well, there's some great wigs around. Okay, let's move on. Before we get to this proposed Prime purchase by Seven, we've got Lorena Allam on the phone, and I did want to talk a little bit about Aboriginal representation in the news media. I mean, that's been a long-standing point of contention, point of debate. And it seems to be changing a little bit. Your appointment at The Guardian, I think, is an example of that. What do you think, Lorena, in terms of Aboriginal representation inside of mainstream newsrooms? You know, there's a few positive signs, or am I being a little bit too optimistic? What's your thinking on that?
Maybe a little bit optimistic.
Okay.
A bit premature. Although it's really encouraging to see that the Judith Nielsen Institute has funded a couple of positions at the Morning Herald now, which is fantastic. It's the first time in, I don't know, more than 30 years, 40 years even, that they've employed an Aboriginal person at the Herald. We were just talking about this today, actually, that of the great legacy of the photographer Mervyn Bishop, another Walkley winner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that the Herald has seen that there is value in employing Aboriginal journalists and seen that the extra angles and the extra access that they can bring to stories in the Indigenous sphere. So that's really encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the rest of the media, and you know, my countrywoman Brooke Boney at and commercial TV. That's a huge step forward. It's great to be at The Guardian. I'm really, really happy to be there, to be in a mainstream media organisation that wants to do this kind of work. That is a big change. That is a big step forward. But the public broadcasters do need to lift their game when it comes to diversity on air and diversity of content. Mm. I think having worked for decades at the ABC is very well aware of how far it's come in terms of Indigenous representation, but just how far it also needs to go in you know, fully incorporating Indigenous viewpoints and Indigenous commentators into their news coverage.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, look, as a general statement, journalism is a very white profession.
Very, very white and very middle class.
Yeah.
So, newsrooms are very monocultural. Mm. And that's true for all sorts of people, for people from all sorts of walks of life.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's not just a problem for Aboriginal reporters. That's, you know, across the board.
Yeah, it is. And it does affect what gets reported, right?
I think it does I think it does.
Mm.
One of the great things about being at The Guardian is having the opportunity to do these kind of big data projects that really, we hope, are driving attention and driving change on issues that Aboriginal people are really, really concerned about. So whether that's truth-telling about history or policing, justice and death in custody, those things matter to people. So I think newsrooms want to cover this stuff, but they don't know how. And they know that the old ways of doing it aren't the right ways anymore. So I think it's about them reaching out to Indigenous journalists to ask, well, how do we do this?
Yeah, because I mean, I think you're right. It's not. I don't think there's a. Well, maybe there is, but in my opinion, in my experience as well, there's not a conscious sort of anti. Oh, we mustn't have Aboriginal people. It's just that they, as you say, that most newsrooms don't seem or haven't seen any up to now, seemed a way to get there. You know, it's just a question of there. I don't think it's lack of willingness, but maybe I'm wrong on that. Michael, you've been in newsrooms. What do you think?
Oh, I think you only need to look at the sort of whenever people do those all newsroom photographs, sometimes for campaigns like the ones we just discussed, you know, you can always see it in the kind of diversity or lack thereof. So I, you know, wouldn't have really have much to add other than, yes, it's, you know, we're very happy to be hiring two new Indigenous reporters, a reporter and a visual journalist.
And a visual, yeah.
And hats off to Lisa Davies, our editor, for really driving that with the Judith Nielsen.
Yep.
Money, which is fantastic, and you know, alongside the campaign that we started a little while ago about for Indigenous recognition, so I think they're positive signs.
Yeah, long way to go though, hey. Okay, let's moving on. You'll listen to The Fourth Estate with me, Peter Frey, and our fantastic guest this week, Michael Cosio from City Morning Herald, The Age. I nearly said Fairfax, but you can't say it anymore. Nine Entertainment Group and Lorena Allen from The Guardian. There's a big news story in the sort of business side of media this week, and that is the moves by Seven West Media to buy the regional broadcaster Prime in a $64 million bid. So Prime holds free-to-air TV licenses in regional New South Wales and Victoria and Western Australia, the ACT, Southeast Queensland and the Gold Coast. You know, the new boss of Seven West Media said that he was going to start buying and merging, and he's doing exactly that. What do we make of it, though, Lorena? You know, you're out there in the bush, you're out there in regional areas where there's not a lot of diversity, and here we have a regional broadcaster being swallowed up by a big city-based one.
I think it's hard for regional broadcasters to survive without that bigger parent company propping them up, because it's really hard to... It's hard to get advertising. It's hard to get eyeballs on your advertising as a free-to-air station. I think those regional stations are learning, because they're on the front line of this new on-demand viewing that is really killing, you know, free-to-air TV.
Yeah.
So it's in a way, the industry is under so much pressure, it's changing so quickly, that in a way I'm not surprised that the regional stations are the first to go. It's very sad for local journalism, and it's very sad for, by extension, the rest of journalism, because some of the best and brightest reporters who work in the national news media have cut their teeth in local politics and going to local council and coming up through those ranks. So it's a loss to journalism when you see those local stations losing their capacity to cover local issues.
Well, I think you're dead right. I mean, it's a real problem when you're faced with this choice. You either kind of get big or die. I guess to be fair to the Seven West Media, we don't know the details of what they're going to do with Prime. Obviously, there would be cost savings. There'll be probably the first thing they'll say will be cost savings in the back end among the accountants and what have you, rather than frontline people. But we have seen, you know, in the last year or so, closures of in the Wind Network as well, in places like Dubbo and such like. So, yeah, it's not the easiest times, is it, Michael?
No, well, I mean, I can hardly object to, you know, takeovers of that nature, I suppose. But, you know, I mean, I think at least our experience with Nine shows that it doesn't have to always be a negative. I mean,
how is it working so far?
Costs cut in the back end, as you say. So far, the newsrooms are getting along pretty well. So, you know, one wants to be, you know, optimistic about these things as much as possible. I must admit, for a long time, and I sort of thought Prime was Seven as a kid growing up, because, you know, you kind of go to these regional towns.
Well, they're affiliated, aren't
they? Yes.
Yeah.
And then I eventually learned that, no, in fact, they were separately owned. So, I mean, look, I don't have a huge kind of, I don't have any sort of philosophical problem with it, you might say. But it's only really ever as good as the judgment of the company's leaders.
Mm. Yes, okay. Well, we'll see. Wait and see. Just before we leave the show, I do want to ask you both about the stories that you're working on. Or actually, in your case, Michael, you know, it's been about a year since we had all that turmoil in the ABC, which you reported to such an extent you've got this Walkley nomination. How do you feel like the ABC is going under ITA et al.?
Well, I mean, I don't follow it so closely. I'm not the communications roundsman anymore, but... you know, just talking to ABC people, kind of, you know, very occasionally writing about it, it seems like they at least have the spring in their step. Might be putting it too far, but they,
they're not particularly springy.
No, look, I mean, it's all going to depend on what happens in further funding negotiations. Mm. I don't think Morrison particularly wants another huge kind of culture war fight over the ABC. I mean, I could be wrong about that. Mm. But we'll see, obviously, in the budget. But I think at least they have someone who is close to Morrison in ITA, not in the way that Justin Milne and Malcolm Turnbull were close, but someone who I think, you know, he respects her judgment.
Yeah, they can talk the same language, right?
He very much wanted her to have that job. He was presented with other options. He said, nah, I want ITA. Ooh. So there's someone in the chair of the ABC who's got the ear of the Prime Minister on behalf of the ABC, and that can only be a good thing. And I think you're seeing generally throughout the staff of the ABC, they're pretty content with David Anderson as a new managing director.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, we'll see what happens in the budget.
Yeah, we will. Lorena, are you missing the ABC?
Yes, of course. It's like my home, really. Yeah. I mean, I worked there for 27 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, yes. Of course, I miss it. I'm a big fan of the ABC. Yeah. I'm working at The Guardian while the MD and the chairman of the board lost their jobs. It was a bit like watching your house burn down from across the street.
Mm.
So it was quite distressing to watch. And I was getting some interesting takes on things from my dear friends who still work there in this burning house.
Mm.
So it's good to see the new MD and the new chair kind of cool things down and calm things down and present a united front to negotiate with this government, which is hostile for the ABC. There's no two ways about it.
No,
so sending the federal police in to raid you is a declaration, I think. The ABC dealt with it beautifully. And I'd have to say John Lyon's live tweeting the whole event from the room was just the most gripping Twitter thread I think I've ever seen. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a special use of the platform, wasn't it?
It certainly was. So, so it's encouraging to see that ITA has she's popular with the staff, at least the staff I've spoken to,
right.
And they are hopeful that she has the kind of media experience and clout and respect that the person in that job needs to steer the ABC.
Last question for you, I think. What's the next story in terms of that flows out of, say, the massacre map?
Right. We're in the process now of releasing the last lot of data for the year.
Right.
So we've got another 50 sites to add to the map that we've been working with the University of Newcastle to refine. There's a lot more that still need verification, but we'll be updating it in the next couple of weeks with that new data and some new reporting.
Great. Well, watch this space.
Yep.
In the meantime, have a great time in Alice. When are we going to start seeing that? I guess you're there you're there for the closure of Uluru, yeah?
Yeah. So Mike Bowers and I are here in Alice Springs talking to people about heat and climate change. I mean, I'm sitting in a car, and I don't know if you can hear the engine running, but the outside temperature is 38, and it's 4:30 in the afternoon. So that's pretty hot for this time of year. And, you know, we're going out to Uluru on Friday for the closure of the climb.
Yeah. Well, great story. I've got to thank you so much for your time and taking time out of your road trip, and love to have you on again. And really, best of luck with the Walkleys and best of luck for the rest of the week. Lorena Allen from The Guardian. And in the studio, Michael Koziol. Always great to see you.
Pleasure as always.
I hope so. And again, best of luck with the Walkley nomination and everything else. What's your next story?
Well, Can you tell me? I couldn't possibly tell you that. No, I do. I have some good stories in Sunday's paper. You can buy it at all.
Newsstands. Buy it all. And the front page won't be redacted. Or maybe it will. Maybe it will. Who knows? Well, thank you.
It'll be a really good story.
Thank you, Lorena. And thank you, Michael, for your time. And thank you, everyone, for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SCR and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network, and Fourth Estate is made possible thanks to the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favorite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media and politics and a few things in between at your leisure. We'll be back with more very soon, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter, where our handle is FourthEstateAU. A big thanks to my producers. I have two of them this week, Anthony Dockrell and Michael Jones. And my name is Peter Frey, and thanks very much for listening.